Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A major retirement. Justice Stephen Breyer will announce he is stepping down from the Supreme Court, setting up a Senate confirmation battle for his replacement. Then, confronting inflation, the Federal Reserve signals it will soon raise interest rates to counteract surging prices across the economy. And postal problems, pandemic-induced staffing shortages, and delivery delays plague the already beleaguered U.S. Postal Service.
We don't have enough people to process and deliver the mail. In my area, they're actually making deliveries on Sundays in order to try to keep up with the demand.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This is a day of three major news developments, from word of Justice Stephen Breyer's plan to retire from the U.S. Supreme Court to coming interest rate hikes and a NATO rebuff of Russia. But first, the Breyer news and questions about who will succeed him. President Biden said today that he will wait for Breyer's formal announcement. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer cited the president's past words.
During the campaign, President Biden stated that he would choose a black woman as his choice for the Supreme Court, and I expect he'll follow through on that. In the Senate, we want to be deliberate. We want to move quickly. We want to get this done as soon as possible.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said it's too soon to comment. He said Republicans will respond once there's a nominee. But first, Breyer still has to make his retirement official. That could come as soon as tomorrow. John Yang looks back now at his long career.
For 27 years, Justice Stephen Breyer has been a moderate liberal on a Supreme Court that has moved increasingly to the right.
Judge Stephen Breyer.
Nominated by President Bill Clinton in 1994, he sits on a court with a solid conservative majority, secured by three selections by President Donald Trump. The most senior of the three remaining justices appointed by Democratic presidents, he defends positions he has long championed, like abortion rights. In oral arguments last December, he quoted an earlier decision to say that the landmark ruling Roe versus Wade should not be overturned.
To overrule under fire, in the absence of the most compelling reason to re-examine a watershed decision, would subvert the court's legitimacy beyond any serious question.
And gun control, here in the 2008 case that led to the precedent-setting ruling that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to keep a gun in the home. Breyer was in the minority.
Why isn't a ban on handguns, while allowing the use of rifles and muskets, a reasonable or a proportionate response on behalf of the District of Columbia?
Breyer also argues that the death penalty is unconstitutional. Here he is in 2015 on Boston PBS station GBH.
The way it's administered, I said, is sufficiently arbitrary, cruel, unusual now that we should reconsider the matter.
Through it all, he's interpreted the law by looking at its everyday effects on people. In a virtual talk for the National Constitution Center last year, he described his approach.
When you have a statute, and the statute has some words in it, and these words can be interpreted in two or three different ways, and the issue is how to interpret them. What do they mean? And you look at the history, and you look at the purposes, and you look at the consequences, too, and you'll try to evaluate them.
He also seeks common ground in cases of competing rights, what he's called the play in the joints. Here's Breyer in 2011 speaking at the Kansas City Public Library.
But many of our cases, the most difficult ones, are not about right versus wrong. They are about right versus right.
In oral arguments, his questions are marked by humor, spirited give and take with lawyers, and often whimsical hypotheticals, like this one from a 2000 case about whether trademark law prohibits knockoffs.
I mean, you could have a weird situation. Imagine you made a hairbrush in the shape of a grape.
Those characteristics were also on display in a series of appearances with conservative icon Justice Antonin Scalia before his 2016 death.
We're making progress.
I mean, he had unbridled optimism.
Federal Judge Vince Chabria, a former Breyer clerk.
When I was clerking for him, he was of the view that he would be able to convince Justice Scalia that the death penalty was unconstitutional.
Former clerks like Chabria remember Breyer as a considerate, though sometimes absent-minded, boss.
There was one time he walked into the clerk's office and he started talking about a case. And he said, okay, I'd like you guys to research this and that. And then the judicial assistant looked up and said, Justice, none of your clerks are in the room right now. They're all outside having lunch. And he said, oh, okay. And he came out and he joined us and sat down with us and to talk about the cases. But I want to emphasize that, you know, when it came to writing opinions, you didn't see the absent-minded professor quality in the opinions he wrote because he was always so careful to make sure that his opinions were widely accessible.
And they remember his commitment to diversity.
When you go to his law clerk reunions now, you see a group of people in the room that looks a lot like America. Plenty of women, plenty of black and brown faces. Justice Breyer has launched all of those people to the highest levels, and that's a contribution, a diversity-related contribution that will last far longer than his time on the bench.
Former clerk Risa Golubov, dean of the University of Virginia Law School, says part of his legacy is his humanity.
One time I brought my little children, my nieces, my brother, my sister-in-law to meet him and to go on a tour of the court. And my son at the time was about 4 or 5 years old, and he immediately climbed under Justice Breyer's coffee table, which is not what you want to happen when you bring your family to the chambers. And Justice Breyer just sat down on his couch, and he, for some reason, had a children's book sitting on his coffee table, and he opened it up and he just started reading it. And my son, you know, crawls back out from under the coffee table and sits up on the couch, and my niece sits there too. And they both just were enthralled by him. And he was going to meet my son where he was, right?
A graduate of Stanford and Oxford universities and Harvard Law School, where he was an editor on the Law Review, Breyer was chief counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1980 when President Jimmy Carter named him to the Federal Appeals Court.
To be the 107th justice.
In 1993, Clinton picked Ruth Bader Ginsburg over Breyer in his first opportunity to name a Supreme Court justice.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Clinton picked Breyer for the next vacancy. The day the president introduced his nominee, the two jogged along the National Mall.
Who's faster, the judiciary or the executive?
The Senate confirmed his nomination 87-9. After President Biden took office and with Democrats holding a slim Senate majority, progressives pressed Breyer to retire. Last September, Judy Woodruff asked him about his plans.
After 27 years on the court, what time frame are you talking about? In the coming year, are you saying?
Of course, there are many different considerations, and I haven't made up my mind definitely just exactly when, but I don't want to die on the court. And before then, I would like to retire. And just when that will be, I have not fully decided. And I think this isn't the place or the time where I want to go into it in depth.
University of Virginia Law School Dean Risa Golubov.
I think Justice Breyer takes really seriously his role as a protector and a champion of the court. And I think he thinks that in order for the people to have trust and faith in the court, the kind of trust and faith that lets the court do its job, he has to continue to be a neutral judge. And I could imagine that for him, taking a step that might appear to be political in a small p politics kind of way would have felt anathema to his stewardship of the court and its legitimacy in the eyes of the people.
The jobs I've had in the Justice Department.
On the day he spoke in the Rose Garden to mark his nomination, Breyer talked about what it meant to him to be a judge.
I have been given quite a few labels, but I hope no one would mind if I'm particularly proud of one label, that of judge. A judge of whatever court is honored by that name. And so too by the name of public servant.
Labels he has held for almost 50 years, nearly 30 of them on the nation's highest court. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Joining us to discuss Justice Breyer's legacy and the future of the nation's highest court is Marcia Coyle from the National Law Journal. Hello to you, Marcia. You cover this court. You've covered it for a long time. I know it's hard to condense 28 years into just a few sentences, but what would you say Justice Breyer's legacy, main legacy, is?
Well, Judy, I think it would have to be in his approach to judging, where he, whenever possible, was making decisions, would try to make decisions that would work for the people and work for democracy. He believed not just in deciding a case on the basis of facts and law, but he had a broader vision that the Constitution was more than a structural document. It was meant for the ages, and it was meant to work for the people. So I think that's one. And I think the second one would be his concern for the institution itself and how it is perceived by the public. And as you know, because I know you've spoken with him, that he has recently been concerned about the perception of the court in the eyes of the public and what reforms might do to the court, as well as whether the court would be perceived as a partisan body because of certain decisions that it might make, some of which could come this very term.
And in connection with that, he has made a point of speaking about how the court is not driven by partisan concerns. And yet, Marcia, the last time I interviewed him in September of 2021, there was a lot of speculation then about whether and when he might retire. I asked him about the effect that it might have on his decision which party was in power. Here's just a quick excerpt of that conversation. Justice Breyer, do you think it makes a difference when you step down, whether there's not only a Democrat in the White House, but a Democratic majority in the Senate?
Yeah, probably. I don't know for sure. No one ever knows. And to what extent you take that kind of thing into account, it's a personal decision. Justice Scalia, Justice Rehnquist have said you do take that kind of thing into account. Others have been more reluctant to do it. So it's in the mix.
So, Marcia, what would you say is the main reason he's doing this right now?
I'm not sure, you know, knowing him, that he was really ready to go wholeheartedly, because I think he truly loves the job and loves the challenges. But, you know, he's 83. He is alert, active, involved in many different things. So probably that also was in the mix, that there are other things he wants to do, as well as his family. He has a number of grandchildren, and perhaps he wants to spend more time with them.
What does the court lose with his departure?
I think they lose somebody who truly tried to be a consensus maker, someone who, as he once told me, listens very hard when the justices talk in their private conferences for what he called the play in the joints. Was there some room there to bring them together or closer together? And there was one term, the term in which Justice Scalia died, in which he and three other justices formed this group that worked very hard to find consensus and were successful in achieving narrow decisions that brought the court together. So I think they lose that very much. And they lose someone who brought humor to the bench. There aren't that many that are very funny, to be honest with you, Judy. But he could be. And it was in a self-deprecating sort of way. As they've said, he's known for his incredible hypotheticals. I remember one that he gave to an advocate named Canon Shanmugam, that after the hypothetical was written up in the transcript, it ran for 3 pages. And I'm sure Shanmugam had to bite his lip to say at the end to the justice, could you repeat that question? So that's going to be missed as well.
And Marcia, attention turning very quickly, of course, to who President Biden will nominate to succeed him. And just to, as we heard earlier, we're reminded, the president spoke about this during the campaign, during one of the early debates, primary debates. And here's what he had to say about it.
I committed that if I'm elected president, have an opportunity to appoint someone to the courts will be, I'll appoint the first black woman to the courts. It's required that they have representation now. It's long overdue.
Marcia, what's the significance of that?
I think it's very significant. One, it would be another woman, and certainly women are underrepresented on the court. Also, it would be a black American, and they are very underrepresented on the court. She would bring a certain type of diversity beyond her color, and the court needs that as well. So just a reminder, when Thurgood Marshall was on the bench, Justice O'Connor often said that it was the stories he told in their private conference meetings that opened their eyes to a lot of what race meant in America. So it can't but help this court to have a black female on the bench.
Marcia Coyle with the National Law Journal. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Judy.
In the day's other news, the Federal Reserve is ready to ratchet up interest rates in a bid to beat back inflation. The central bank reaffirmed that stance today, and it signaled that the first in a series of rate hikes could come in March. We'll get details after the news summary. Wall Street rallied for much of the day and then gave it all back as the Fed acknowledged that inflation is still getting worse. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 129 points to close at 34,168. The NASDAQ rose about 3 points. The S&P 500 slipped 6. The U.S. and NATO have rejected Russian security demands amid Moscow's troop buildup along Ukraine's border. The formal responses came today in official letters. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said there will be no concessions regarding Ukraine. We'll return to this later in the program. The Secretary General of the United Nations sounded a dire warning today about Afghanistan. Antonio Guterres told the UN Security Council that millions of Afghans face extreme hunger in the dead of winter.
6 months after the takeover by the Taliban, Afghanistan is hanging by a thread. For Afghans, daily life has become a frozen hell. We need to jumpstart Afghanistan's economy through increased liquidity. We must pull the economy back from the brink.
Most foreign aid to Afghanistan dried up after the Taliban took control in August. Guterres appealed today for action to free up $1.2 billion in World Bank funds. In northeastern Syria, Kurdish-led forces backed by U.S. coalition airstrikes have retaken a prison. They had battled Islamic State fighters who attacked the prison last week. Kurdish officials said the militants had used child detainees as human shields. This was the biggest ISIS attack since 2019. New COVID-19 infections reached 21 million worldwide last week, the most since the pandemic began. The World Health Organization reported the new data today. It also said that the global rate of increase in infections is slowing. Back in this country, the search is still on for 38 migrants believed missing off of Florida's Atlantic coast after their boat capsized. On Tuesday, authorities found a lone survivor. He said a storm swamped their boat as they tried to cross from the Bahamas on Saturday night. Later, the Coast Guard found one body. An official said today, time is growing short.
It is dire. The longer they remain in the water without food, without water, exposed to the marine environment, the sun, the sea conditions. It is every moment that passes, it becomes much more dire and unlikely that anyone could survive in those conditions.
Federal agents are treating the incident as possible human smuggling. They opened a criminal investigation today. A Texas man is now charged with selling the gun used in a hostage standoff at a Dallas-area synagogue. A British man held four people for 10 hours earlier this month. They finally escaped, and he was shot and killed by the FBI. The alleged seller is accused of possession of a firearm by a felon. And the city of San Jose, California, has adopted the nation's first law to make gun owners carry liability insurance. The city council overwhelmingly approved the ordinance last night. Gun owners say that it would violate their Second Amendment rights, and they sued today in federal court. Still to come on the NewsHour, what the United States' latest response to Russia's military buildup means for Ukraine.
the Postal Service struggles with staffing shortages and delivery delays. A children's book author connects Holocaust history to the present, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Federal Reserve is shifting its approach to the economy and to monetary policy. It is a major change after many months of holding interest rates at near zero levels. And given the pandemic, it is not without its own risks. But as Lisa Desjardins reports, the Fed chairman said the state of the economy required changing course.
Good afternoon.
From the Fed chair today, a clear message the central bank hopes to clamp down on inflation with an interest rate hike in a matter of weeks.
The committee is of a mind to raise the federal funds rate at the March meeting.
Fed Chief Jerome Powell is signaling what would be the first Fed interest rate increase in 3 years and the potential for more in future months. This as rising inflation weaves into daily American life, with costs up in gas stations and grocery stores. In December, prices were up 7% over the previous year. But the Fed must also balance the continued spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus and its effect on the economy. On that, Powell indicated reason for optimism.
Health experts are finding that the Omicron variant has not been as virulent as previous strains of the virus. If the wave passes quickly, the economic effects should as well.
Powell noted that unemployment is low overall, 3.9%, arguing the job market can handle a shift from the Fed.
I think there's quite a bit of room to raise interest rates without threatening the labor market. This is, by so many measures, a historically tight labor market.
But the jobs picture is not the same for all Americans. Unemployment remains high for Black Americans at 7.1% versus for whites at 3.2%. That economic concern for still struggling Americans is on the front burner at the White House, where President Biden met with corporate CEOs to try to revitalize his stalled Build Back Better plan.
The Build Back Better plan lowers prices for families and gets people working. It creates the best educated workforce, and hopefully in the world, and ensures it remains the most dynamic and productive economy in the world.
Meantime, businesses like this cafe just 2 miles from the White House are feeling a shaky economy.
You can see when people are not getting the extras, when they're getting coffee, drip coffee instead of cappuccino. You can see it.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
Let's break down a bit more of today's developments and how this fits into the larger economic picture going forward. Greg Ipp is the chief economics commentator for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, welcome back to the NewsHour. So first question, how much do we expect the Fed is going to raise interest rates and how quickly?
Well, they signaled about as clearly as they could that the process was going to get started in the month of March with a quarter point increase. Now, the last time they gave us detailed projections, they thought that they would raise rates three times, three-quarter point increases this year. But the clear body language from Chairman Jerome Powell today is that the risks are that they will do more, possibly quite a few more rate increases this year. And the reasons why are quite simple. In the last 2 months, all the data they look at has made the case for higher interest rates even stronger. Inflation, if anything, has gotten worse since we got that bad 7% number. And the job market is just extremely strong with far more job openings than there are unemployed people. So the two things the Fed cares about most, which is a strong job market and low keeping inflation down, the evidence on both fronts tells them that rates right now are way too low. So I think there's a possibility, in fact, a probability that they will raise rates at least four times this year and possibly many more times than that.
Possibly many more times. And you're referring to his body language. What made you come away with that impression?
Well, the last cycle where the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, they did it every other meeting, which meant every 3 months, so about four times per year. So reporters asked him, well, is that going to be the same kind of template you follow this time? And he repeatedly emphasized the difference between the economy today and the economy in 2018, 2019, when they were last raising interest rates. The economy is stronger today. The job market is tighter. And most important, inflation is a lot higher. It's around 7% instead of 2%. So the message he's trying to say is you cannot look at the slow pace of rate increases last time around and believe that's an appropriate model for how we're going to behave right now. I think the Fed is worried that they are, in the jargon, behind the curve. That is to say, they're facing an economy and an inflation that they're sitting here with interest rates way too low already for the strength of the economy and how high inflation is now. And they have a lot of work to do to get rates to a more appropriate level.
So we heard in Lisa's report, obviously, reference to why they're doing it now. Anything you would add to that to help us understand why they've made this major course correction?
I think that they have a lot of people, including the Biden administration, the economy is just not behaving the way they thought a year or two ago. Like coming into this last year, the expectation was that the economy would, like after the global financial crisis a decade ago, be one where there was prolonged and very high unemployment, a lack of spending, a lack of demand, and just lots and lots of unused capacity. And it's really kind of the opposite. We just have lots and lots of demand, red hot demand, you know, like shortages of everything. The problem today is that there's too much demand and not enough supply. And so all the fiscal stimulus we had, all the monetary stimulus we had, they did the job. They got the economy back to a healthy state. But now we're in this situation where policy is completely inappropriate for the shape of the economy.
So
there's one last point here, which I think that the Fed and everybody is struggling with, which is the virus. We're discovering that the virus just doesn't lead to weaker spending, fewer people going and shopping and fewer people going in restaurants. It also means fewer people are willing to work. And that adds to the problems reopening the economy and adds to these inflation risks. And it makes a very complicated picture for the Fed.
So we heard Chair Powell talk about the connection between the economy and the pandemic. I mean, how much is it thought that they are tied together, that if the pandemic lifts, the economy gets better? I mean, what's the thinking?
Well, in the perfect world and the world that they thought we were going, that they were assuming until a few months ago, was that as the pandemic receded, you know, some of the distortions in the economy would go away. Supply chains would normalize. Prices for things like furniture and durable goods would come back down to earth. People would start shifting their spending from goods to services. And people who are worried about going back to work because of the virus, they would now be willing to go back to work. All the childcare issues would be fixed. The longer the virus hangs around, the more of these waves we get, the less that state of normalcy is likely to return. In fact, you have to sort of come around to the idea that there's going to be a new normal that doesn't look like the old normal, and it's going to be a world where some of these shortages may be very persistent. And I think that weighs heavily on the Fed's thinking, and it adds to the inflation risk that they are now trying to tamp down with their coming rate increases.
And in just a few seconds, Greg Ipp, is it believed that this is going to work, that it's going to wring inflation out of the economy in the right way?
I think there's several reasons to be somewhat cautiously optimistic. Most people still believe that the prices we're seeing right now are indeed distorted by the pandemic. And with time, those things should go away. It's simply not the case that used car prices will keep going up 30% every year. There are good reasons to believe that as the Omicron variant wave works its way through and more people acquire some form of immunity, labor markets will normalize. The other thing that's happening is we're not going to get another $2 trillion stimulus program from the federal government this year like we did a year ago. So just the absence of that fiscal push means that demand is going to cool off a little bit, and that will provide some scope for inflation to return to normal. But I would emphasize that there's just enormous uncertainty about that, and that's one reason you see markets behaving in such a volatile way.
Enormous uncertainty. Greg Ipp with the Wall Street Journal, we thank you.
All right, thank you.
As we reported today, the U.S. submitted a written document that responds to Russian demands over Ukraine and NATO's future. The document rejected Russia's core demand that Ukraine never join NATO, but suggested other diplomatic off-ramps to try to defuse the crisis over Ukraine. Nick Schifrin has more on the day's developments.
In Moscow today, an effort to save diplomacy. U.S. Ambassador John Sullivan left the Foreign Affairs Ministry after delivering a written document that Secretary of State Antony Blinken said reiterated a core U.S.-NATO principle.
I can't be more clear. NATO's door is open, remains open, and that is our commitment.
But that is the very commitment Russia demands the U.S. break as it deploys equipment and 100,000 troops to Ukraine's border, including new video today of fighter jets in Belarus to Ukraine's north and ships off Crimea to Ukraine's south. Back in December, Russia demanded that NATO close its open door to other European countries, including Ukraine, and roll back all its forces and weapons in Europe to 1997 levels. Giving in to that demand would rewrite decades of U.S. and NATO policy and the map. In 1949, NATO's eastern border was Italy. By 1997, it had added four more countries for a total of 16. Since then, in five rounds of expansion, it's grown to 30 countries, including those on Russia's border. In 2008, NATO said Ukraine and Georgia would become future members.
There is no change. There will be no change.
But what the U.S. is offering, mutual limits on Eastern European exercises like these in Poland and missile deployments by reviving the defunct Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF, that banned an entire class of nuclear weapons.
We also do lay out areas where we believe that together we could actually advance security for everyone, including for Russia. The placement of offensive missile systems in Ukraine, military exercises and maneuvers in Europe. Potential arms control measures, greater transparency.
But even before Blinken spoke, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov suggested it wasn't good enough.
If there is no constructive answer, and if the West continues its aggressive course, Moscow, as President Putin has repeatedly said, will take the necessary retaliatory measures.
The U.S. and NATO are also trying to deter war by reinforcing NATO's eastern flank with European jets, European soldiers under NATO command, and as many as 8,500 U.S. troops, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
We have plans in place that we can activate, execute on very short notice. So what we have done over the last weeks is to increase readiness.
To reassure allies, the administration is working to replace Russian natural gas that Europe relies on in case Russia cuts exports. But the U.S. admits that ultimately, whether diplomacy lives another day will be decided by Vladimir Putin.
The document is with them, and the ball is in their court.
For more on the confrontation with Russia and where things stand diplomatically, we turn to Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who's held a number of foreign policy positions at the State Department and on the National Security Staff during Republican administrations. Richard Haass, welcome back to the NewsHour. So the U.S. has sent its written responses today. Why is the Biden administration rejecting Russia's key public demands?
Well, Article 10 of the NATO alliance talks about the openness of the alliance for other members. And we can't be in a situation where Russia can essentially determine who gets to be a NATO member or not. That's the province of the alliance. That's in the sovereign decision-making right of the United States and its 29 allies. So it's simply, and to say one other thing, Nick, Russians know that. What we don't know is whether their positions represent an opening bid from which they're prepared to negotiate and compromise, or whether this is essentially setting up diplomacy to fail.
So those negotiations or those compromises that the U.S. wants to talk about include limiting military exercises in Europe, restricting missile deployments, and new arms control agreements. Is that the right approach, do you think, that the Biden administration is taking?
Well, I think it's all fine. And to that, you could probably add negotiations dealing with the Russian presence in eastern Ukraine. The real question, again, is whether it's enough for Mr. Putin. He's manufactured this crisis. He's placed 100,000 troops on the border. For him to walk away, if you will, take the off-ramp, means that he has to think there's enough in it to save face, to talk to his own people, to tell the world that he didn't climb down because he was pressured. So I simply don't know. I don't think any of us know whether this will be enough for him to justify a change in his behavior.
Secretary Blinken today stressed allied unity, but as you know, there are differences. Germany, for example, is blocking weapons going to Ukraine and refusing to threaten to cut off the pipeline, Nord Stream 2, in case Russia invades Ukraine. Is NATO really unified?
No, but then it wasn't unified during the Cold War either. There were always tensions within the alliance about how to deal with the Soviet Union, about the wisdom of going ahead or not going ahead with various military deployments. So we're seeing similar things now about how to deal with Russia. The Germans are obviously very skittish. Their energy dependency simply adds to it. There's also simply a lot of history here and a lot of geography here. And not surprisingly, in a country, in a, an alliance of 30 countries, you have a real range of opinions. And that's part of the challenge facing the Biden administration. Putin knows that. And it's one of the reasons he might, I emphasize the word might, think about a scenario where he uses a limited amount of force, because the more limited the scenario, the deeper the cracks are likely to be within NATO.
One of the challenges that Putin faces also is the calendar. And this morning we heard from the Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, who suggested that Vladimir Putin would not launch an invasion during the Olympics, which start next Friday, because it would take away from Xi Jinping's big moment. Do you agree?
I think it's probably right. Russia's too dependent on China strategically, economically. It's one of the reasons that sanctions may not have the desired effect. That takes you through February 20th. After that, he probably has a month in which the weather is cooperative, the ground is largely frozen. So all things being equal, if he is thinking about something that involves an intervention, I think you're more likely to be looking in the month that follows the close of the Olympics.
And I'm wondering also if I could ask you about a little domestic politics here. Yesterday, we heard from the top Republican in Congress, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, say that Biden was, quote, moving in the right direction in confronting Russia and supporting Ukraine militarily. But very often on the top cable channel host, Tucker Carlson on Fox, he urges the U.S. to go soft on Russia. Explain that dichotomy. Where is the Republican Party today on Russia?
It's hard to speak about the Republican Party as a singular entity. I think the mainstream or relatively mainstream Republican Party pretty much agrees with the Biden administration, essentially strengthening NATO, threatening Putin with various sanctions, bolstering Ukraine's ability to resist an invasion or occupation, but maintaining some diplomatic off-ramp. I quite honestly don't fathom or understand the sympathy we're seeing on parts of the far right for Mr. Putin. He is, you know, repressive to his own people at home. He interferes in American democracy. He uses military force with some abandon, both in Europe and the Middle East. He gets up every morning and he basically thinks about what can he do to undermine the world that the United States has helped build, how to undermine American democracy. So I simply don't understand the sympathy he seems to be generating in some quarters.
Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.
A key part of the Biden administration's plan to distribute free COVID tests depends heavily on the United States Postal Service. White House officials say that effort is going well, with tens of millions of tests now being shipped. But the U.S. Postal Service remains under intense scrutiny for its customer service and delivery, its finances, and how its workforce is dealing with COVID. Jeff Bennett has our report.
Diana Wall of Arlington, Virginia, says she went a full week without mail delivery last month.
It was terribly frustrating. If I'm mailing checks, let's say for health insurance or things like that, then I begin to wonder, are those being delivered?
For me, the medication is life-saving.
Paul M. of Atlanta, who asked that we not use his last name, relies on at-home delivery of his medication. In 2021, he says those deliveries through the U.S. Postal Service started taking longer to arrive. Then one week in November, he says nothing showed up.
That package that I missed, it showed that it was delivered. Showed on the U.S. Postal Service website when the tracking. It showed that it was dropped off at the front office at my apartment complex. It wasn't.
He says he missed a week's worth of doses.
I had to space out my medication and actually ration it. Which isn't good for any medication. Ever since then, I have not received my medication through U.S. Postal Service anymore.
And he's one of scores of people nationwide who complain to the NewsHour about delivery delays at USPS for everything from medication to bills and birthday cards. The U.S. Postal Service reported that during this past holiday season, it delivered more than 13 billion pieces of mail and packages with an average delivery time of less than 3 days. But reports of delays and frustrated customers are still piling up. We asked postal workers why. Mark Dimenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union, says one reason is worker shortages caused by COVID.
We have between now 15 and 20,000 people a day who are quarantined, officially quarantined. So that has an impact on service.
Since the start of the pandemic, the union tells the NewsHour, nearly 200,000 of the roughly 650,000 Postal Service employees have had to quarantine at some point, with more than 90,000 positive cases. Kimberly Carroll, president of the Iowa Postal Workers Union, says she's seen a similar COVID crunch.
We don't have enough people to process and deliver the mail, and we're working even more hours. In my area, they're actually making deliveries on Sundays in order to try to keep up with the demand.
The Postal Service says it has put in safety measures, including face mask requirements, social distancing inside facilities, and contact tracing protocols to keep workers safe. USPS also told the NewsHour that it's increasing staffing as necessary, and in most cases, it has the resources to ensure on-time delivery. Beyond the pandemic, postal advocates point to a larger overhaul of the independent government agency led by Postmaster General Louis DeJoy as the main reason for the issues. His plan is aimed at fixing long-standing financial problems at the U.S. Postal Service.
I would suggest that we are on a death spiral.
In early 2021, DeJoy testified before Congress and argued the agency needed dramatic reforms to avoid a financial catastrophe. The 10-year plan unveiled last March, among other things, opens longer first-class mail delivery windows from 1 to 3 days to 5 days in some cases, reduces post office hours, and raises prices for postage.
Our dire financial trajectory, operational and network misalignment to mail trends, outdated pricing, infrastructure underinvestment, inadequate people engagement, and an insufficient growth strategy all demand immediate action.
Action that's needed, he says, to avoid $160 billion in losses over the next 10 years. The U.S. Postal Service declined NewsHour's request for an interview with the Postmaster General. Since 2007, the U.S. Postal Service has reported net losses of more than $90 billion, in large part due to a 2006 law that requires it to pre-fund employee health care and pensions. Another factor is the major drop in mail volume, which drives profits. Over the last 20 years, the Postal Service says first-class mail shipments have declined by half. To address this, one part of the 10-year plan shifts emphasis toward shipping packages, which is more profitable. Veteran Postal Service employees, like Kimberly Carroll, say they understand the financial challenges, but are wary of DeJoy's plan and the impact on customers.
We're seeing the impact, the change in service standards, the raising of prices, and the changing in our networks. Our customers are not getting the deliveries that they are expecting in the time frame that they are expecting, and they're frustrated because they're paying more for the product.
Changes made to postal delivery under DeJoy, who's a major donor to former President Trump, sparked outrage in 2020 when critics blamed him for service slowdowns ahead of the November election. Democrats accused DeJoy of attempting to sabotage the delivery of mail ballots, linking him to the former president's anti-mail-in voting rhetoric. DeJoy denied those allegations. Democrats are now at odds over how to handle DeJoy, who can only be dismissed by the Postal Service Board of Governors. I asked White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about this recently.
What's the White House position on the persistent delivery delays that the Postal Service seems to be experiencing, at least anecdotally? And DeJoy's current place is Postmaster General.
Going back to the holidays, 97 or 98% of packages from the Postal Service were delivered on time. So there may be anecdotes from that 1 or 2%, but that's actual data. We have expressed concerns in the past about DeJoy's leadership. DeJoy, that was a little slip there. DeJoy's leadership in the past, that has not changed.
The Biden administration is relying on the Postal Service as a critical partner in its COVID-19 strategy. tasking it with delivering rapid COVID tests to any American who wants one. Deliveries that started ahead of schedule.
We're making 1 billion at-home tests available for you to order and be delivered to your home for free.
Mark Dimenstein of the Postal Union says that underscores the value of the Postal Service.
What's happened in the pandemic and what's happening with this test kit project, again, just fundamentally shows to the people of the country how important it is to have a public entity. There's no private entity that could get a test kit to everybody's home because a private entity is going to move packages based on whether they can make a profit. Postal Service is a service here for everybody.
With the mission, he says, not to make a profit, but to serve the American people. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeff Bennett in Washington.
People across Europe, Israel, and the world are preparing to observe International Holocaust Remembrance Day tomorrow, commemorating the millions of European Jews killed by Nazi Germany. The day was created in 2005 by the United Nations to sustain public awareness of the genocide, which studies show has rapidly declined in recent years. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro shows us one creative attempt to educate younger generations. His story is part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
The pen and ink drawings are his trademark, intricate, layered with meaning in thousands of dots. Dots children's book author Peter Cease wants his readers to connect.
I have almost like a third language when between the minimal text and the picture I can load in some symbols and things which maybe will make you open the door or try to think about something else.
His books have a wide demographic target, young readers to teens. Many are profiles of heroic figures in history.
Galileo Galilei, who doesn't give up, and he's a genius. And it was like, the idea was like, children among you, one of you can be Galileo Galilei.
So this is my awards storage place.
He's won scores of awards, including the so-called MacArthur Genius, for books that include The Wall, about his own coming of age behind the Iron Curtain. His latest, Nikki and Vera, tackles a darker subject, the Holocaust, and a quiet hero, Nicholas Winton, who saved 669 mostly Jewish children from almost certain death.
As a young man, Nikki traveled all over Europe.
The idea came to Cease in Europe in 2009 on a visit to his native Prague, where a group of those children were retracing their long-ago train journey to England. A celebration was planned there for Winton's 100th birthday.
It's wonderful that it did work out so well, because after all, history could have made it very different.
Winton was a stockbroker in London when he heard of disturbing developments in Czechoslovakia, which had come under German occupation in the months leading up to World War II. He went to Prague hoping to evacuate children whose parents were willing to let them go to England for what they hoped would be temporary safe haven.
So he himself immediately sets up a little office, writes the lists of the children, and manages to get trains, visas, places in England they would stay with foster families.
Urgency drove creativity. Sometimes Winton faked documents or bribed Gestapo officials, doing whatever it took to get as many children out quickly before war would shutter borders.
If I bribe the train people, they will give me train. If I bribe the Gestapo person, he will be looking the other side. So I appreciate that he was creative in this terrible situation.
Winton's effort was not the only so-called kinder transport or child rescue program in the period leading up to World War II. What's different here is that once done, he just went on with life and didn't tell a soul about it.
He helped open a school, he got married, he found an old people's home. He never told anyone about the children.
Until nearly 50 years later, when Winton's wife, Gretchen, found his scrapbook in their attic and passed it on to researchers who tracked down some of his children.
And all of a sudden, they are old.
That led to a meeting on a BBC broadcast.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please?
And it was this video that drew Cease to one of those children, Vera Gissing, and Nikki and Vera began to take shape.
Vera was the queen of cats.
Cease illustrated Vera's idyllic life before the war, people and things she would leave behind, her parents, grandparents, her horse, and of course her cats. But Vera's mother feared the Nazis and joined hundreds of desperate parents in lines outside Winton's office in the Prague Hotel. Cease draws this in muted black, white, and blue.
He took their photographs. He found train connections. Spies kept watch.
3 days before her 11th birthday, Vera boarded a train with 76 other children, including her sister. For almost all, it would be the last time they saw their parents.
Little Vera finds family, which is very poor, but the husband says, I cannot beat Hitler, but I can at least help one child who will survive this whole time.
My biggest takeaway is how incredibly fortunate we were.
87-year-old Ava Paddock was just 3 when she boarded the last of Winton's trains.
First of all, that my mother would allow us to go. Giving up a child or children is amazingly difficult. Stops me right there even now.
Paddock was one of very few children whose parents survived the war and reunited with her in England. She moved to the U.S. and a career in education and later mental health care. She has no worries that Cease's book is too dark for young children.
Every child has understood being left out of a group, being meanly treated. To me, the book, and when I talk about it, is really a message of altruism, actually.
The book is filled with illustrations that she says encourage readers to dig deeper, even at older ages.
Children will ask questions and then you go in their direction and in as much depth as they can. But the story, you know, simply can't die, and it's going to die unless we start with children.
Nicholas Winton died in 2015, aged 106. Vera Gissing, whose own memoirs informed so much of Cease's book, suffers advanced dementia. She's 94. I reached her daughter, Nicola Gissing, in Bristol, England.
I think on some kind of deeper level, she realizes that there's something about her and something's being made and her story is still being told.
A story both she and Peter Cease say is very relevant today, a time when millions of children find themselves in migrant journeys in search of safe haven.
I realize these are all human beings who have dreams, how impossible it is for the parents, what parent would even put the children on the train or tell the children, go, you have to go now, this is the only solution to survive. All of a sudden, all these children who were crossing the borders, who were trying to live somewhere else, who were immigrants like me, it all connected.
Nikki and Vera has been translated into Italian, Chinese, Korean, and starting on this International Holocaust Remembrance Day, it is available in German. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Irvington, New York.
It just grabs your heart. And Fred's reporting is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. And on the NewsHour online, if you are immunocompromised or otherwise medically vulnerable to COVID, what do you do if you test positive? We look at treatment options that may help keep eligible patients out of the hospital. You can find that at pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.